God for judgment. I reformed him of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Now this word soul, I've been studying the Bible for over 55 years, about that. And I've had trouble with the difference between soul and spirit during that whole time, and I still don't have it as clear in my mind as I wish I did. Sometimes the word soul is used for the whole man, 70 souls that went down into Egypt. Well, that's the whole man that went down. Sometimes it's used of that life that animates the body, that expresses itself in breathing. Now, it's not the breath itself. I didn't say that. It's that life that animates the body, that expresses itself in breathing. Now, the spirit is always more restricted. The spirit is that part of man that is in the image of God and is able to think and to reason and to rule and to control, and all of this that's answerable to God. Someone had described it like that. Here's the body. Right, now the soul animates the body, but the spirit is that part of the inward man that looks unto God. Whereas the soul, which animates the body here, relates it here, and after a while the body will die when that's gone. But it's more concerned with the earthly aspect of it, the spirit with the eternal or the spiritual or related to God. I don't know whether that's so or not. But at any rate, I know that sometimes the word soul is used for the whole man, the spirit, and the body. But the spirit is never used for the animal life. It's never used. Never restricted, so far as I know. I've tried to locate it, but I haven't found where the spirit was used in the sense that the soul is there. So the spirit is the higher element of that inward man that relates one to God because it came from God. And that's the sense in which we were made in the image of God, it seems to me. Right? So here then is he became a living soul. Now, and Jehovah provides a place for it. And Jehovah God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground made Jehovah God to grow every tree that is pleasant for the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, it's quite possible, though I don't know that it's so, that back here when it says that these things hadn't begun to grow yet may have reference unto Eden. Now, the word Eden means delight or pleasant. And so here this garden was a garden of delight or a garden of pleasantness, a very pleasant place. And in this garden, God placed the different kinds of trees, herbs, and fruits and things for man's good and benefit. And there he put the man whom he had formed. Out of the ground came forth these things that we just said. But here's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life. Two trees there separate tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the tree of life. Now, it's interesting to note, and I didn't jot down those passages. I have them in another place, but I forgot to jot them down. That the tree of life is found only in three books in the Bible. Here is the tree of life back here in the Garden of Eden. Tree of life mentioned here, in Genesis. Here in Genesis, in the Garden of Eden. Then second, it's mentioned three times in the book of Proverbs. And certain things here as a tree of life. And the third time it's mentioned is in the book of Revelation. That is the second chapter. And then moving on over to the last chapter there, the 22nd chapter rather, 21st chapter, you'll find it mentioned. All right, now here's the tree of life. Now this tree of life here, it was removed. Now here, he's speaking of certain things as a tree of life. But he uses that word three times here in Proverbs. If you want to look it up. And here in Revelation, it's used a number of times. But here when we're removed from the tree of life here, to be returned to it over here after a while. Now, our tree of life is what? The tree of life today, where we are today, is the cross. Cross is spoken of as a tree. He hanged upon a tree. Hang upon a tree. Right, now our return to the tree of life is through the cross. I'm going to make that just a little bit different. There's our tree of life here, which is the cross, and it's through that, this is our tree of life, through which we come eventually here, to the tree of life, over here in the after a while. So the cross is the tree through which we come to the tree of life in the after a while, crucified with Christ. Well, maybe that's a thought that you want to explore just a little bit. Rather an interesting thought to me. Right now here, and so here the two trees, we'll mention the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in a moment. And a river went out of Eden to water the garden, and from thence it was parted and became four heads or streams. That's most unusual. Ordinarily, when that thing like that talks about, well, here's a river, and here's another river here, and here's another one that comes down here, and here's a third one here, and these all meet here from other heads. But now this one is different. This one here, here's a tree that goes out, and evidently means as it goes out, it spreads in these four different directions. It's a rather difficult passage there. I don't know that I really understand that meaning, the significance of that. But at any rate, here are the four. Maybe there is a meaning to that that I've never comprehended. I don't know. But anyway, it went out of the garden. From thence it parted, became four heads. Now, we generally think of the four heads becoming one. Now, some of these we do not know or able to identify. The name of the first is Pishon. I don't know where that one is. That is it which compasseth the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. And the gold of that land is good. There's bdellium. That is a kind of a resin, I believe, that was used. And the onyx stone, a precious stone. We're not sure what that was. The name of the second river is Gihon. The same as it that compasseth the whole land of Cush. Well, now, Cush is found in Upper Egypt. Upper Egypt there. Well, is that the Nile River? I don't know. I don't know. Because I don't know of any other Cush in the Bible than that Cush. And then the name of the third river is Tibical. Well, now, that's the Tigris. That they've been able to identify that from Daniel. That's mentioned in Daniel also. The Tigris, or toward the east. That is it which goeth in front of Assyria. That is, Assyria lay east of it, and this is the western border of it. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. Right now, two of these we can identify. And these two head up in Armenia, up here, to the north. One of them comes around like this and flows on down and comes in here. And the other one comes in like I believe it's inside. It comes in like this and comes around. Comes on down, and they meet down here. These two are not too far apart up here, which has led some to conclude that Eden was up here in this particular area here where these two rivers head. But remember the flood. When you're trying to identify these things back here, remember that the flood came, and no doubt there were great upheavals here. At that time, as we'll learn, we come to the ninth chapter. 6 to the 9th chapter, they are dealing with the flood. So here the flood, no doubt, left the face of the land in much different than what it had been. So I don't know where Eden was. Some have concluded that Eden was down here toward the end of these rivers down here where they come together, and that this was a more lush spot here for it. But I don't know. I don't have any idea. Might have been out here in Arizona. I don't know. Been a pretty good place for it. And California said it might have been down. I know where the Texans would put it. So we really don't know where it was. So we'll just leave that with the Lord and find out someday if he ever makes that known to us. But right now we don't. But at any rate, it was a wonderful place wherever it was. But generally it's thought of up in Armenia where these two rivers head. But that I don't know. Let's say, there are many, many changes, no doubt, after the flood or during the flood. Well, we move from that. And now then the next year, and Jehovah took the man and put him into the garden of Eden to dress it and to keep it. Now underscore that. That work was not the curse that God placed on Adam and Eve. Work is a blessing. It is good for man to work. In fact, to the business, that's one of the troubles of a lot of young people today. They've never been taught to work. They don't know how to work, and they don't want to work, and so they have to go. So the next thing is to get into trouble. Now, work is good. Work is a grace. It's a blessing. So God put in that to dress it and to keep it. We'll notice what the curse is in a moment. And Jehovah God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. For in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Now all of us familiar with that. Now here is the positive law that God gave me. Here's a positive law and a negative law. The positive law is you are to dress and to keep the garden. This is the work I'm giving you to do. The negative command is, I shall not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, surely, it seems to me that with all of the blessings and the benefits that God gives to man in this beautiful garden, everything fresh from his hand of creation, just blessing upon blessing, that ought not to have been hard to abstain from that one thing, surely. But it was. And so here's the one restraint placed upon them. In the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. Now people have used that many, many times and said, well, he didn't die on the day that he ate that. Yes, he did. What is death? Is it not a separation? Yes. As the body apart from the spirit is dead, says James. So faith without works is dead. Right? So it's a separation. This is death. Right? So when man sinned, that separated him from the relation that he had formerly sustained with God. And so it does yet. When man sins, that brings about a separation between him and God. And this is the sense. Now physically, he did die, but not in that day. But he died eventually. But he died in his relation to God. And that's what sin does. You are dead in your trespasses and sins, Paul said. Right? Now, Jehovah's, now comes that the beginning of the home. All right? Now, here then is the beginning of the heaven and the earth. Here is man is created. He relates both to God and man. Put in the beautiful garden of Eden there to dress it and all that. But he is alone. Right? Now, verse 18. Here with the creation of the woman is the divine origin and the beginning of the home. And I never preach a sermon on this subject, but if I don't begin with this passage, I come to it immediately, because here is the beginning of it. And Jehovah God said, it is not good that the man should be alone. I will make him a help meet for him. That word means answering to him, or suitable. You hear people quote that, a help mate for him. That word is not mate. It's a help suitable for him. A help compatible to him. A help answering to him. Answering to his needs. Answering to him. Right, now here's another point. If in the beginning we have God and the Word of God and the Spirit of God and a great host of angels about the throne of God, can I not conclude from that in a divine way, that God is a social being? That is, that he doesn't want to dwell alone and doesn't dwell alone. He's never been without his word. He's never been without his spirit. How long was he without the angels, or when they were created? Of course, we don't know. When you get to dealing with eternity and infinity, you're in a realm outside of our ability to comprehend. So don't try to comprehend it. You get into trouble when you do. Just accept by faith that there is an infinite space out there, because that's all we know about it, and that God is eternal, without beginning, without end. Absolute in that. I can't comprehend it, but nevertheless, I have to accept it. I believe that. And I know you do. All right? Now, coming back to this, man then was created in the image of God. Would he not therefore be a social being in that likeness to God? I think that he would. Right, so it's not good that man should be alone. Now let us note next. And out of the ground Jehovah God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the heavens, and brought them unto the man to see what he would call them. Whatsoever the man called every living creature, that was the name thereof. Now, this shows another aspect of man, and that's his intelligence. A highly intelligent being, capable of giving names. Now, I think these names are not just a name, Jim and Bill and Joe and that like that. But it was a name that grew out of the character of the animal, or the likeness of the animal. It was a name that would describe that animal in some way. So here then was an insight in how, how long this had been after the creation, I don't know. How long it took to bring these animals before the man, I don't know that. But don't worry about that. Simple fact is that when they were brought before God, the man gave them a name. But now, what was the purpose of that? It was not to try to find a help suitable for man. God knew there was no such creature among those creatures. But it seemed that that was to inspire within the man, or ignite within the man, a realization of his loneliness. That here, every one of these animals here has a mate, a companion. Here's the male and the female. Yeah, I stand alone. And so, no doubt, it was to make the man realize his need for a companion suitable to himself. That seems to me to be the idea. I know it wasn't the other, but God knew he wasn't going to find one there. Right? And the man gave to them the names of the cattle and to the birds of the heaven, to every beast of the field, but for man there was not found a help suitable, meet, answering to him. Not a one. Right? Now God already knew that. But wouldn't that create a desire for a companion? All of the animals, each has the counterpart, but I don't. Right? So with that, Jehovah God then caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof, and the rib which Jehovah God had taken from the man, made he, or builded is a better word. The Hebrew word is building. Because this is not a creation. Now, he didn't create something new here. Here's why he builds something out of something that already was. He took the rib, and of course it was flesh to it. Of course, the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. So it wasn't just a bare, scraped bone. It was a bone with whatever flesh went with it, and then the other grew back together there. And closed up the flesh instead thereof, and the rib which Jehovah God had taken from the man, made or builded he a woman, and brought her unto the man. And the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman. That is Isha, or the female for the man there. Woman, because she was taken out of man. Now, now she is the counterpart. I know you've heard it said many times, and I think correctly so, that here she was not taken out of the head to rule over him, nor out of the feet to be trodden underfoot or ruled over in that wrong sense, but taken out of that part closest to him here, a rib here. Maybe we could say nearest to his heart, nearest to his very being here, indicating there that she is equal to man. She's the counterpart of man. And is equal here in humanity, in that. All right? Now notice what man said. Now this next expression, I believe personally, is a parenthetical expression that's inserted by Moses. Because when Jesus quoted this in Matthew 19, have you not read, he that made them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So if there are no more two but one flesh. Right? Now Jesus said that he who made them said this. Right? Therefore, it seems to me that this 24th verse is a parenthetical statement inserted by Moses, or rather by God, through Moses here. And so it's a statement from God and not from Adam. I think Adam said the 23rd verse. But it's doubtful if he said the 24th, for I think Moses said that. In fact, God said it through Moses, no doubt when Moses wrote this, as a parenthetical statement. shall leave his father and mother, shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. And they were both naked, the man and the wife, and were not ashamed. Here they are, clothed in the absolute innocence of the first creation. But we could tonight, if we had the time, we're not preaching a sermon on this matter of the home and all of that. But this clearly identifies the unity of the husband and the wife. And Jesus said, what therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. All right, it's God that joins together. It was God that created the man. God that created the woman for the man. And it was God that joined them together. So here then is the beginning of that which we call the home. All right, start from that passage there and go on and preach a fine sermon on it. But we'll not do that tonight. Unless you have a question you want to ask over there. You do raise it. All right, now, when the curtain falls on chapter 2, the closure falls on the scene in Eden, the man and the woman here fresh from the hand of God. Sin is not entered into it uncontaminated by it. Everything fresh, beautiful in its pristine beauty and glory. Wouldn't it have been great if it had been continued like that? Wonderful. Great, but it didn't. Now, I want to raise this question. Did man have to sin? Emphatically no. We'll see in the next chapter his sin was a free will act on his and his wife's part. That leads me and has led me to the conclusion that back here when God created the man and the woman, that God had a purpose here. Here was a purpose I mentioned a while ago. Now in this purpose of God, I don't know what it might have been. What would it have been like if man had not sinned? I do not know. God does not reveal that, but God never acts apart from a purpose, from a plan. There was an objective in what he does. So when he made the man and the woman here, there was an objective there. There was a purpose that God was going to work out. Now, did God know that man would sin, or did he not know it? I have my view of that. You have your view, and our views will probably differ. If I would express mine, I don't mind it. Now here then was a purpose if man should sin. Here was a purpose if man should sin. Now inasmuch as man sinned, then the Bible, the whole Bible is a revelation of what? It's a revelation and a carrying out of this purpose here for man's redemption as a sinner. That doesn't say that God knew what he would do. Now you're going to say, somebody's going to say, well, if God didn't know it, then God's not omniscient, is not absolute. I don't agree with that. God knew what he would do. To me, here is the answer to that. God was able to create a being capable of making a choice independent of God's foreknowledge of what that choice would be. I don't like that expression, God didn't choose to know. I don't like that expression. I don't use it. I say that God was capable of creating a being that God was able to create a being capable of making a decision independent of God's foreknowledge of what that choice would be. And so now, God puts him in the garden, tells him what to do, what don't do. Now, man was a moral being. There's nothing clearer in this very second chapter than that man was a moral being capable of making a choice. And was free to make a choice. Now back here, as he made the choice back there, the choice that he made, he was capable of making a choice, that choice, in that choice, he sinned. Right? Which we're going to look at in just a few moments. That's all I want to deal with. If I get the time tonight, if I don't, I'll move on. We'll take it next time. All right, now, you come over here. Now here, man's redemption is also a matter of choice. Here's the choice of sin. Here's the choice of belief, repentance, and baptism. We'll call it obedience. Here now is the choice of acceptance and obedience. So man from the very beginning is a creature of choice. Now when I teach on the book of Job, I'm convinced that all suffering is consequential. It's the consequence of choices that men have made through the ages. I'm an heir of all the choices from Adam down to the present. So here then was a being capable of choosing, and God knew what he would do back here. He knew what he would do if man should not have sinned. I have no idea what it would have been like. I know it was wonderful when the curtain folded on the second chapter. I know that. I know that whatever it was, God had a wonderful and glorious purpose in mind. But since man sinned, then what's carried out is a purpose for human redemption. He sinned. So here then is his redemption by choice. And over here in the after while in heaven is a consummation of that purpose. Whatever the purpose was back here for man, here is the consummation of that purpose. Now here's another thing. People say, well, why did God put that tree there so man could sin? Is there any moral glory in doing what one has to do? No, there isn't it. God put man there and capable of making a choice. Now man made his choice there. And if it had been obedience, well, here would have been an expression of love and faith in God, confidence in him. All right? Now, I'm going to read this down to verse 8 as far as I want to go tonight. I could go on through the chapter, but it'd take me too long. That would be a good place to stop. Now, the serpent was more subtle. Probably clever is a better word. He was more clever, because the word subtle means that he was more undermining, underhanded than the rest of the animals, which would mean that the rest of the animals were underhanded. But the word clever indicates here a disposition that he had by creation was more clever than any beast of the field which Jehovah God had made. And he said unto the woman, now notice now he comes and she's not amazed at it. She's not surprised, which that leaves us wondering about. A lot of things here we wonder about. But we certainly can get the idea. Yea, hath God said, you shall not eat of any tree of the garden? Kind of maybe a flippant way. Yeah, God said, you shall not eat of any tree of the garden. All right? And the woman said unto the serpent, of the fruit of the trees of the garden we may eat, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Did God say that, or did she make it up, or how? I don't know. I wouldn't try to say that. If he did, my first sin was a lie, if God hadn't said it. So maybe God had said it, or at least intimated it. But if God told him to address it all, it seems to me he had to touch it. But we'll leave that with one of those things we don't understand. Neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Now the indication is here that evidently she didn't hear God tell Adam that, but Adam told her that. So she knew what God had said, didn't she? Wasn't any question what God said. She hears what he said. She even says a little more than we have a record of. So she knows that. So she's no excuse for her doing what she did. I think already, before she ate of that fruit, there was a disposition being developed in her against what God had said to her. A kind of a sense of rebellion. I don't want to be put under any kind of control by anybody. It's the very spirit of this ERA movement today. It's a disposition of women, I don't want to be under submission to anybody or anything or any being, whether God or man. I ought to be under subjection. Seemingly, this is the beginning of this woman's thinking here, which should never have been. And of course, that was rebellion against God. Neither shall you touch it, lest you die. So she didn't like this idea of being under restraint. And the serpent said unto the woman, you shall not surely die. For God doth know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as God, knowing good and evil. Now that would be your spiritual or your intellectual eyes open there, as if what difference would that make if she already had these blessings. Now remember this, class. Thing I try to keep before you and me as I study this, that here we are under all these blessings. Here's the wonderful blessings that God has put these individuals under. All of these are expressions of his love. Now, not only these blessings, we're going to see in a moment that God communed with them in the cool of the day. He would come and they commune with man. Here's a perfect communion, fellowship with God. So here then, for all of the physical blessings that they enjoyed and all of the spiritual blessings in this relation to God. One restraint, just one. Don't eat of this tree. The man couldn't stand that. The woman couldn't stand that. And we're a lot that way. I just don't want any restraint put on me at all. I want to be my own boss. Do just as I please. This is the downfall of that. That's pride. So apparently, maybe it's pride. I don't know what it is that leads the woman to do this. But at any rate, the devil said this, and the devil lied to her. Jesus said in John 8:44 unto the Pharisees, "You are of your father the devil, and the lust of your father it is your will to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and standeth not in the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father thereof." Right? So here we see that character in him right here. He murders these two. They die when they eat of it because they're separated from God. He's the author of that. So in that sense, he is a murderer. He's responsible for what they did. He's a liar. He entices them with a lie. Right? And so here, as the devil came unto her, here, well, Eve now, in this position. Here is Eve, and here is God. God says, "You shall not eat of it." She knows that. Right? Here's the truth. Here is the devil. Right? Now, the devil says here, "In the day you eat thereof, you shall not surely die." God is appealing to Adam and Eve on the basis of the truth of His Word. His Word. Now, His Word's involved in this. This is what God said. People belittle the Word of God. That's what Eve did. Over there, the devil, he entices with a lie. Right? The devil's approach always is through a lie. He deceives by the power of sin and deception. If sin did not deceive, men would not commit. Men sin because they are deceived by the lie of the devil to do what they are doing. Alright? So here he says, then, that God knows you're not dying, but your eyes will be open, no good and evil. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and she gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. Now let me note here, here is the appeal unto Eve. The appeal unto Eve here is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride or vanity of life. This is the basis on which he made his appeal to her. Right, John says over here, all that's in the world, the lust, that's 1 John 3:15-17, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the vain glory or pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. So here was Eve, and here are we, here being appealed to by the same avenue. Now in between us and Eve is Jesus. Here is Jesus in the 4th chapter of Matthew, Matthew 4 here, where the devil said, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become bread." That as an appeal to the desire of the flesh, strong desire of the flesh, cast yourself down from the temple. Here is the eye. Fall down and worship me and I'll give you these kingdoms. Here is the vain glory of life. Now, the same basis on which the devil appealed unto Eve, he appeals unto us, as he appealed unto Jesus. Eve yielded. Jesus overcame. You and I are between the two forces of God and the devil, making a choice. Now, God appealed on the ground of truth. That is, through the truth here, their knowledge of this truth, their understanding. Right? Now, God had taught them. God had spoken. Here's the Word of God. God had told them what to do. God appeals to that. Well, let's put that down to intelligence. God appeals under intelligence of an individual. Here is his intelligent understanding, we'll put it that way. Here then is the intelligence of that individual, the understanding of it, and his love for what God has done for it. Right? So both of them are appealing under what? They're appealing under the will. Here is the will. God appeals to the will through truth. And appeals to the intellect through his word and the love for what he's done for it. The devil is appealing to that will through a lie. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. What both God and the devil want and seek for is the submission of the will of the individual. Now, God does it through truth revealed in His Word as an appeal to the intelligence and to the love of that individual to bring the will into subjection to Himself. I make a choice. Here's that matter again of choice here. As I said a while ago, Eve made a choice here. Adam made a choice. I make a choice. You make a choice. Jesus made a choice. We make that choice. All right, so here the choice that we make then, of bring the will and submission to God or unto the devil. But remember this, that God's appeal always is through truth to the intellect, understanding, love of the individual to bring the will unto him. The devil's appeal is to a lie. The lust of the flesh, the eye, and the pride of life, which are going to pass away. But both are seeking the will. God doesn't have any other way of doing it. And the devil uses false religion and power and force, but all of that really is false. That also is a part of his great lie of deception. Now let me close. When the soul that woman saw that it was good for food, delight to the eyes, to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and she gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. The eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and now stripped of their innocence, they stand before God in the nakedness of sin. And they made themselves aprons, and they heard, or a better word, their girdles. The Hebrew word is girdle. They made themselves girdles there, they heard the voice of Jehovah God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of Jehovah God amongst the trees of the garden. All right? What do we have in that? We have this consequence of sin. Sin, first of all, made cowards out of them. They wanted to hide from the presence of God. They didn't want to meet him. Sin also deceived. They thought they could hide from God. Sin also made liars out of them, or made cowards out of them further, in that each one wanted to blame somebody else. I'm going to start there next time, because I don't want to keep you too long. I think an hour and a half, maybe a little too long. So we'll stop there next time and join ourselves right there. But anyway, they start to hide themselves from the presence of God. Now, the reason I'm not going on is I want to deal in here with the promise that God made here, and also the prophetic action down here, that both of these point to a provision for salvation in the future, but it'll be by the Lord. Now, do I have a question? Now, yes, sir. Well, he comes through instrumentalities, yes. He comes through individuals, through a subject thing. No, I don't think he can force or take an animal into it, no. And even here, there's a lot about that we don't understand. He took the serpent and used him there. And just why he used him, I don't know. He said he was more subtle or more cunning or more clever, and that might have been the reason of it. No, he can only act today through human instrumentality or deception through these. No, he cannot. He cannot force anybody to do anything. His power is limited and curbed from what it used to be. Yes, sir, another hand was up. Yes, sir.
I realize that God didn't create evil.
No. Alright, let's go back. There's some things back there that we do not know nor understand. But there are two or three passages that I think will help you in this matter. One is Colossians 1, and I think I used that, might have used that last time, I may not have. I've been doing so much preaching and teaching, I forget why I said what. But in Colossians 1, look at that passage there for just a moment. Speaking of Christ, who is the image of the invisible God, who is the firstborn of all creation. So in his relation to God, he is the image of God. All right. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him were all things created. Now look at his relation to creation. For in him were all things created, things visible and things invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created through him and unto him, and yet he is before all things, and in him all things consist. That is, are held together here. Now in this expression here, for in him are all things created, in the heavens and upon the earth. Now notice, things visible and things invisible. Now whether throne or dominion or principalities or power. Now the devil is very definitely a principality and a power. Alright? I believe that he was a created being, created good, for he was created unto him. That is, Christ, you see, is eternal with God as the Word of God. So he was created to perform some work there, whatever it might have been. Good. Whatever it was good. Now like the angel that followed him in 2 Peter 2:4, and also in Jude 6, the angel of sin, he cast down to Tartarus here in 2 Peter, and in Jude 6, the angel that left their own principality and their proper habitation. Well, now, what does it mean by their own principality or their proper habitation? That for which they were created. What may have left that? When an individual leaves that for which he was put into a position, that is the violation of law, isn't it? That's sin. Sin is the transgression of law. So when these angels left their own principality, the proper habitation, they violated that for which they were created and the place that God gave them there, therefore they sinned. Now, since we read in Matthew 25:41, Jesus said to them on the left hand, nobody over here so I can use this one, depart from you cursed into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. That indicates that these were angels of his, and apparently he led in that rebellion. Revelation, the 12th chapter, the war in heaven does not help you, but that's not what he's talking about there at all. So my understanding is that the devil was a created being, a principality or power here, to exercise, to operate in a certain dominion that God gave him. Now when he did that, he sinned. So then you have also in 1 John, the 3rd chapter, and verse 8, whoso sinneth is of the devil, for the devil sinneth from the beginning. So back here somewhere, when you get back there to the beginning, now Christ already was. Now let me bring that beginning down here. Down here is the beginning now, when Christ brought these things into existence. Well, when we get back to that, the devil already was and apparently had already rebelled against God. Now then, God allows him to continue here, for man could not prove his true moral relation to God apart from an opportunity or a chance here to rebel against that. So actually man's sin goes back of eating the fruit itself. It goes back to that inward spirit of rebellion and resisting this idea of being under some kind of restraint. I think that was the beginning of it. And I would say that that's pride. Pride there, as evidently pride led the devil to do what he did, it apparently led man to do what he did, though I don't know this. I just know it was rebellion against God. So God allows the devil, but the end of the devil is clear. Matthew 25:41, depart from me, cursed in the eternal fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. So here's an eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. Then those on the left hand, depart from me into that. Then in Revelation 20:10, the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where also the beast and the false prophet, and they're tormented day and night forever. So I cannot believe in what some philosophers call dualism. I don't believe in an eternal good being and an eternal bad being. I believe that Satan was created good. Now, why he left, why he did what he did, we're not told. We'll have to accept that. But I believe that's the answer to that. At least that has satisfied me, though. Did that help you on that? Anybody have a question beyond that? Yes, sir.
Do you have any indication here of time now involved in this
No. At the sixth day when he rested, and now we've gone back and reviewed that, but now when this took place, no. You don't have how long it went on, how long they were in the garden before this took place. I know of no indication of that time. None whatever. All right, anything else? Well, we appreciate this fine class. Good class. Brother Hugh, would you start down here and count us, please, sir? You don't mind, I appreciate that very much. Now, you got me and you, didn't you?
Yeah,
38. We're too short of last time. Well, if we just keep around 35 to 40, we're delighted. Thank you for coming, and we'll see you next Tuesday night if the Lord will. All right, we'll begin that passage at that time.